Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So I am on the northbound Northern Line platform at Bank Station, because I am going to have an adventure. I'm going to go to Edgware with a man who also recently went to Edgware. We'll get into that shortly. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Samir Jaraj, and I'm a journalist, charity worker, and housing person, campaigner, maybe.
And that is the train number 013 to Edgware, which we're going to get onto now.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Ellich, and this is Skylines, the City Metric podcast. As you'll just have heard, this is going to be a sort of on-location episode. We start by trying to record on the tube. It does not go as well as I expected. So don't worry if you're getting annoyed by the tube background noises. After a couple of minutes, we give up on that and move to a cafe where occasionally I fear in the background you can hear the noise of the bloody espresso machine. In keeping with that theme, in this opening, which I recorded purely to reassure people the sound quality would improve, I'm sat outside in the Angel Islington shopping centre where all you can hear is drilling. Some days you just want to give up, don't you? Anyway, stick with us. There's an excellent anecdote about the reason why we tried to record this on the tube, followed by a nice discussion about rent controls and the like, and the trap that the British rental system has a large chunk of the population currently caught in. So stick with us. It is worth bearing with the noise, I promise. So, okay, we're on the train now. Everyone else on the train is studiously avoiding the weirdos recording a podcast, as is right and proper. So the first question is, you don't live in Edgware, right?
No. I live in Hackney, and I work in Kentish Town in Camden.
So why exactly did you go to Edgware?
So I was going to a meeting in around Angel about the launch of the Mayor of London's report on rent control. And because I hadn't read the email properly, I tried to go to City Hall and at London Bridge, and then realised I had to quickly get on the Northern Line and get up to Angel. So then when I got to Bank, I realised that the doors had closed in on my bag straps, but I couldn't get my bag out the door.
Okay, but that's fine. You just get it out the next station, right?
Yeah, so I kind of realised that things were starting to go wrong once we'd gone way past Angel and were up into King's Cross, Euston kind of area. And then when we got to kind of Colindale and we got actually out of the underground, I realised that the doors just weren't going to be opening on that side again.
Change here for Circle, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan Lines and National Rail Services.
And the announcer was no help.
Just going to say, there are going to be moments where we just have to stop for the announcer, and there's not really a way around. This is, try and think of this as less as a podcast, more as a stupid experience you're having. So you're trapped in the doors. At any point, did you start to panic?
I think initially, because I realised that this meeting I was already kind of late to, I was going to be even later to it, and then I was kind of I'm not going to.
We're just sitting down, okay.
Saying, oh, no, I'm not going to be able to make this make this meeting. And it was like, you know, like eventually this, you know, the door's going to open on this side. And it was kind of frustrating.
But were you definitely sure about that? Like, is it not possible that due to some quirk of fate, you could have just been trapped in the door indefinitely?
It was possible. I figured if I got to, like, Edgware and nothing had happened at that point, I would then, like, seek help. But I kind of felt the need to, like, abide by both that kind of, like, maybe it's that male thing of not asking for help, or that Londoner thing of not asking anyone for help on the tube.
Yeah, that is kind of the ultimate faux pas, is to actually speak to another human being on the tube, which is why people are starting to give us slightly strange looks now. The Northern Line is slightly screechier than I was imagining it might be when we agreed to do this, but, you know, style it out. We knew what you were getting into. I should also say, for the benefit of anyone who doesn't live in London or isn't intimately familiar with the tube map, Edgware is the end of the line. It's a long way out.
Yeah, so it's up in the, like, northwest London, total end of the line. It's leafy, like, lots of suburban housing. I've got some family that live there. You kind of, like, go there maybe, like, once a year for a family thing.
Well, that's nice. Did you say hi?
No, I didn't get a chance. I was kind of, like, I was, like, panicked enough that I felt the need to kind of return immediately.
I have a terrible confession at this point in the podcast. I am slightly worried that this is going to be completely unlistenable. So while the original plan was to go all the way to Edgware, I'm going to make a radical suggestion, which is we find a cafe in which to talk about housing. What do you reckon?
Sounds good.
So you're now in a cafe in the Angel Islington area of inner North London, which was by my stomping ground till I moved to the East End last year. As we've got close to doing this podcast, we've got progressively wussier about it. Like, the original plan was to try and reenact the whole affair by deliberately getting trapped in the doors and then being stuck there to Edgware while recording a podcast, because that seemed like a funny thing to do on social media. But I think by the time we actually sort of met up this morning, we were both thinking that maybe that was in fact a bad idea, and that, you know, we would be sending the wrong message and possibly bringing the entire London Underground network grinding to a halt. So now here we are in this cafe. There was a moment we did a sound check where it was slightly worse than recording on the tube, but we're hoping this is going to work fine. Let's get into the actual meat of this conversation. Among other things, you're the co-author of a book called The Rent Trap.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
So The Rent Trap is a book about how we kind of got into this kind of renting crisis and some of the potential routes out of it. So kind of looking at how private rented housing has become a much bigger part of housing, both for young people and for poorer people, and why kind of the routes out either into, like, social housing or into own occupation have been closed off over the last few years, and what that means socially, what that means politically and economically as well.
Okay, well, let's start with sort of the first principles there. Why are so many more people, this is like one of those questions with a really obvious answer, but it's good to spell it out sometimes. Why are so many more people renting now than did 30 years ago? Why don't they all just go and buy their own home?
Well, I mean, there's a few different things to that. So, like, firstly, there are proportionally less housing. So there's, you know, like, social housing collapsed basically in the 80s under the impact of Right to Buy and of kind of financial restrictions placed on councils that stopped them building housing. Then under New Labour, there was a lot of emphasis placed on councils outsourcing social housing to housing associations who'd never been able to build as much housing as councils were.
Is that just a capacity thing? Because the average housing association is, or at least was, smaller and has fewer staff than the average council?
Nowadays, in my opinion, no. But it's because councils had that strategic role of being able to kind of do work with land, to actually do things on a much larger, grander, more strategic scale, whereas housing associations traditionally were small and specialist organizations that focused on a particular clientele. And their criticism of councils was, you are too big and monolithic to serve a particular community, whether that's a national community, so for example there are lots of black housing associations, or whether that's about, like, people with mental health issues, learning disability, whereas now housing associations, the ones with tens of thousands of homes across multiple parts of the country, and are actually increasingly becoming the kind of monolithic base of housing.
This is why I stopped halfway through my question, is because once upon a time they were relatively small organisations, where now some of them are managing as many homes as a lot of the councils ever did, right?
Yeah.
But the difference is they have neither the sort of control over planning powers nor the kind of statutory duty to house people in the same way. So they have a sort of different, they have different abilities and different incentives as well, I guess.
Exactly. And it used to be, for example, councils used to give land over to housing associations in exchange for being able to nominate who could live there. So they would house people off the housing list. And similarly, you know, the housing associations used to be and receive subsidy and grant from central government because building social housing was deemed to be a good thing by central government at the time, whereas that has collapsed as well. So housing associations are being encouraged to sweat their assets, essentially to become more commercial organisations, which is why you see several housing associations move more towards providing more generic, what they call general needs housing, and focusing on things like shared ownership rather than specialised housing and focusing specifically on groups of people that have like higher needs.
We've already got slightly off our original track here, as tends to happen when I talk to anyone about housing. But to kind of go back a bit, so one of the reasons that private renting is through the roof is because there's much less social housing around. Presumably property prices are also in the mix here, right?
Yeah. So one of the reasons why people can't escape into owner occupation is that house prices are significantly higher, and the kind of like deposits on them in particular are kind of prohibitively expensive to private renters. You don't really have the capacity to build up savings. So one of the stats in the rent trap, but it might not be the kind of current one, was the like private renters would struggle to save like £150 a month towards the deposit.
Because rent is higher, the cost of living is higher, wages haven't gone up for 10 years really.
Exactly. And then on top of that, again, like as one of the effects of private renting expanding in the kind of the buy-to-let style kind of situation, is you've had the growth of lettings agencies who predominantly fund themselves through lettings agency fees. But lettings agency fees are now thankfully banned, but in that era, they were a way for lettings agents essentially to charge large amounts of money, mostly to private renters and sometimes to landlords. And
yeah, this is kind of where it's been one of the easier problems to solve, is because they were stiffing both tenants and landlords, right? So it's much easier to say these people are just parasites and not have a third of the House of Commons think, well, hang on, that's also me.
Yeah, absolutely. There was the one group of people that both landlords and tenants actually like both hated was lettings agents, because they both felt that they were being screwed over. And then there were lots of examples of overcharging that was brought out. I mean, there are also kind of like examples of the BBC did an investigation a few years back in London where there was examples of lettings agencies racially discriminating against tenants, where they were perfectly happy to accept landlord instructions to not house African Caribbean people. And they were really kind of like the unaccountable face of housing. They, you know, because there were lots of ways that they could defraud people or could screw people over.
So, okay, we kind of talked a bit about why the private rental sector has grown so much in the last generation in Britain. Is that necessarily a bad thing? One of the things you hear a lot in this debate is, well, why are we so obsessed with home ownership? Like in Germany, people rent for their whole life. What's wrong with doing that? What is wrong with just renting?
Innately, there's nothing wrong with just renting. It's the quality of what that renting is. Renting in the UK currently means insecurity. It's because you can be evicted without reason under Section 21 of the 1988 Housing Act. It's unregulated in terms of rents that can be charged as well, which is one of the reasons why we talk about rent control. And also, like, in terms of condition of private rented housing stock, it's traditionally been much lower quality housing, much more likely to be overcrowded, much more likely to be at the crap end of housing. So, you know, there's nothing innately wrong in renting as long as that's your choice and it's a decent place to live.
So it's not renting itself that's the problem, it's so much as the insecurity that comes with renting in the British system particularly.
Exactly, and that insecurity underpins so much of kind of the issues, because it's about the power dynamic between landlord and tenant. And so, for example, my co-author of the book, Rosie, she was evicted for asking her landlord to replace a broken set of drawers. And it's just that kind of like...
That's mental. Even if you don't want to replace the drawers, why can you not just say no? Why do you have to be like, well, no, not only am I not going to do it, I'm going to throw you out. I don't want your money anymore. Like, what was the logic there?
So from what I remember, he said something in the lines of like, I don't like women who talk back.
Charming.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, I would, if I was ascribing a rationality to it, I would imagine that this particular guy saw, oh, here's someone who's willing to stand up to me, they're going to be trouble. I can quite easily find someone who will pay the same amount of money or more for this room.
And because it's essentially a seller's market, because it, particularly in cities like London, there are so many people fighting over so few flats, which is why rents are so high. Landlords think they can just kick someone out and get someone in probably at a higher rent. That's actually, as I understand it, that's not necessarily true, and rents have been flatlining or even slipping a bit. But that's still the impression a lot of people have, right?
Yeah. Very much. The people are kind of used to that scenario of having no power or no market power and not feeling able to ask their landlord for repairs or for any kind of improvements, even if they might actually kind of like be up for it. I mean, like, I remember one potential landlord of mine, and actually kind of ended up going there, but a friend lived there. He was fine and good, like a decent person. He seemed to be kind of like wanting the people living in this place to be okay. But he decided to give management over to some lettings agent that was very much of the school of no, we won't do that, or oh, we're going to ask the landlord about that and never getting back to them. So.
Yeah, I often get the impression it's not the highest quality people who end up in the lettings agent business.
Please mind the gap between the train and the platform.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
So what's the solution? Like, you've thought about this more than almost anyone else. How will we fix this? How are you going to fix this for us?
So for me, and I think kind of in the book as well, it was this combination of progressive legislation and regulation. So, for example, banning no-fault evictions, rent control, banning lettings agency fees, making landlords accountable through licensing in the same way that like a taxi driver is licensed and is accountable for their actions, and on the other side, an active renters movement to enforce those rights and to establish collective power in a way that individual renters don't have.
Okay, so I want to unpack a couple of those. A lot of those are sort of fairly straightforward. Like a licensing scheme for landlords seems quite sensible because it is kind of ridiculous you can be responsible for someone's home life and be completely invisible to the authorities if you abuse that power. Mm-hmm. Banning lettings agency fees we've already covered. Let's talk about rent controls. So I'm going to slightly play devil's advocate here, because I really don't like this conclusion. I want to believe that rent controls can fix things, but from what I've read, one of the few things you can get economists from the left and the right to agree on is that rent controls are bad, because they will kind of create an insiders-outsiders thing where, like, people who have rent-controlled apartments stay with them forever, but there's suddenly a shortage of rental property, so people who don't have those can't get anything at all, so end up renting even more expensive or more unofficial things if they can. It enables landlords to play tenants off against each other. There are other ways in which they can kind of, like, force tenants to differentiate themselves other than simple financial ones. And these are arguments put forward not just by people on the right, but by, like, Paul Krugman, the sort of left-leaning economist who writes the New York Times. Why is that wrong? Because I really want to believe that we can just set rent controls and sort this out.
So one of the issues behind that is that people often kind of, like, talk about rent control or invoke rent control, and actually rent control is a broad set of different types of systems. So the kind of, like, the New York system is very different from the Danish system or the Venezuelan system, and that actually kind of, like, we can think about what we want to do with a rent control system, then design it around that. So I believe at the very least that you can establish a system of rent control that at the very least mitigates to a significantly less level the kind of the bad impacts. And
tell us a bit about the different forms of rent control. Like, what are the things you can change with it?
So, for example, like perhaps the weakest form of rent control would be limiting rent increases during a tenancy. So you have, like, a shelter, I think, have talked about this, and Labour under Ed Miliband talked about this. You'd have, like, a 5-year tenancy, and the landlords would be limited to like inflation level increases during that time. But then once your tenancy came to an end, they could then set a new rent at whatever level they want to. Whereas, for example, the Danish system is based far more on basically limiting the amount of profit a landlord can make. So you take the cost of building a block of flats or building a home, and you can charge a certain percentage of that to the tenant per year. Say you can charge, like, 5% of the value of the cost of construction over that year. So that means that's a 20-year payback. There's some kind of, like, leeway around improvements, around kind of whatever. So, but that's a much longer term thing, and that's based on here is you're going to be able to make this amount, like, a reasonable amount of profit on this, but not be able to double a rent for no particular reason.
So the point is, it's not as simple as, like, it doesn't have to be as simple as saying, right, this is the rent and that is it. There are ways of kind of connecting it to landlords' costs or general inflation, or just so it kind of looks a bit more like, you know, a reasonable share of someone's living costs rather than something that can suddenly spike 50% without warning.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, interestingly, kind of the first type of rent control in the UK introduced in 1915 was a flat rent freeze. The rents were frozen at pre-war levels because there was essentially an economic crisis brought about by the fact that the UK was at war and that landlords decided to raise their rents.
Sure. But presumably that was also made easier by the fact there must have been slightly fewer people around once you get into a war and, like, you know, a measurable percentage of the population is in a ditch in France somewhere.
So interestingly, like, the place that was the real kind of, like, centre of rent control, like, or, like, fight for rent control was Glasgow. And what had happened was that all of these workers from elsewhere in Scotland moved to Glasgow to work in munitions factories. So there was short-term higher pressure on housing in Glasgow, and so rents were raised. And then when people couldn't pay them, they were summarily evicted. And there were all these kind of, like, these campaigns, especially there were kind of families of people who were fighting in France or wherever, and they were being evicted. And it's very much a thing of, like, this landlord is evicting people. But one of the things that really put pressure on the government was that this rent control, this rent strike that that happened in Glasgow threatened to become an industrial strike within the munitions factories and shipyards in Glasgow, and so they quickly passed this kind of rent restriction act.
Well, this gets us on to the other thing I kind of wanted to talk about that you sort of listed in your, you know, ways of dealing with the rental crisis. It's the idea of building kind of a rental movement. So you're a trustee of Generation Rent, which, you know, regularly the City Metro will probably be aware of as a campaign to kind of improve the lot of renters, basically. Do you think this is a form of the civil society that we will be seeing more of, like, you know, renters banding together to exert political pressure as a group?
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, this like ongoing issue of private rented housing being a much larger part of like housing stock in the UK means there'll be much more renters for a longer time, and that actually having some type of like collective protection and form of lobbying is only seems to make sense within that. That actually kind of thinking about some of the civil society organisations that are about kind of people living more precarious lives, whether that's kind of like forms of trade unionism that are kind of working with people on insecure contracts, but actually kind of these people living within insecure housing and people who are able to come together and campaign for that. And you see kind of examples of renters unions, for example, in the United States, in Germany.
So what does a renters union actually do? Because, you know, you talk about a trade union, you sort of imagine it's involved in pay negotiations, orchestrating strikes so that the workforce can exert its sort of combined influence. What does a renters union do?
So it can do a number of things, and again, it depends on what the system that you're dealing with is. So in the US, like a tenants union will do a lot of like legal advocacy, representing members and tenants' interests within like the courts. They will lobby for legislation, or especially within the US, like city legislation. In the UK, we've only relatively recently had the kind of start of the London Renters Union and Living Rent, which is the tenants union in Scotland, and they're doing political lobbying to an extent. They're doing a lot of what, if I can remember the term correctly, is kind of like action casework. So where like a member is, for example, under threat of eviction and trying to find ways to either block that or using kind of strength of numbers against a landlord or lettings agent that's not necessarily dealt with that before. They're used to dealing with people who don't have any power. So, for example, like a while back, I actually did an article for New Statesman on evictions. And as part of that, I went to eviction court. I mean, there isn't a defined eviction court in the UK, but I went to the court where evictions are decided. And most private renters don't turn up because they have so little basis they can actually appeal an eviction on. But whereas a renters union can essentially make life difficult for a landlord or lettings agent, they can pick a lettings agent, they can use that collective power to try and force some form of negotiation, even if there isn't a kind of a legal structured process to do that.
It's not just about having the legal rights, it's about your ability to actually enforce those rights, basically. And as it stands, a lot of tenants, they tend to be younger, poorer, in less secure work. Yeah. They can't necessarily show up at a court in the middle of the day with a lawyer saying, okay, here's our line.
Exactly that case. So if you look at kind of how the Scottish Tenants Union started, it literally started with this particular unpleasant landlord called Mark Fortune. Let's talk like who was predominantly like a student landlord in Edinburgh, and he was just like this really kind of quite horrible landlord. And eventually one of his tenants, a guy called Jamie Finn, complained about something, and he turned up at his door and threatened to shoot him. It wasn't even that I've done in the kind of like the I'm going to shoot you. It's like, oh, I've got mates who had done for shooting someone. Anyway, so Jamie recorded this conversation, and it was became the basis of a legal case against Mark Fortune, who then countersued Jamie, and then all these other tenants of this guy kind of joined in. And eventually they won a significant part of their case. He was, under Scottish law, you can be deemed to be not a fit and proper person to be a landlord. So his ability to be a landlord was taken off him. He transferred the the company to someone else and then fled the country. But anyhow, so it was this group of people that came together against this actual landlord, who then formed the Edinburgh Private Tenant Action Group, and who then formed the basis of the Living Rent Tenants Union in Scotland. But this actual kind of thing of like, people weren't lining up at the door to take their case against this guy. They very much had to do it themselves and force people kind of on board. And it's quite similar if you look at the ability and willingness of councils to enforce against landlords. It's patchy at best. A lot of councils don't invest in that kind of enforcement. A lot of housing enforcement falls to environmental health officers rather than people who are kind of specialists as like tenancy people.
And council expertise has been gutted over decades, right? I mean, even before austerity, they were losing a lot of these people just because the councils have repeatedly faced budget cuts and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, again, like one of the impacts of the housing crisis is that councils are struggling to find places to house people who come to them as homeless. And one of the places that they can house them is with private landlords. So councils can't be seen to be too anti-landlord because they need them to house people off their homelessness lists.
I do want to be wrapping up, but just as a last question, like, we've obviously seen in the Western world, as the economy has changed, old school trade unionism has become a less powerful force in politics and civil society. Do you think like renters unions could be a way of kind of playing that sort of role where, like, you know, it's where the less powerful members of society to kind of exert their collective power in a way that perhaps not had an atomized economy the last couple of decades?
Absolutely. And so like one of the, I suppose, like my kind of thought on kind of like organizing is as the collective workplace has become a place that like fewer and fewer of us actually kind of do work in, one of the places that we can start to organize on is like around like our neighborhood or around our experience as renters. Even though that's not without challenges, we don't have a single employer, or we have a much more kind of like fragmented landlord class of people. But actually, it's potentially the basis upon which we can start to organise in that kind of economy that's more about atomised workers, it's more about insecure work, insecure living.
Well, that's a nice positive note to end on. There is power in a union, so maybe there is hope for the future. If anyone wants to get in contact with you, what's the best way?
I'm on Twitter. My handle's at @SAJERAJ.
Samir, thank you very much.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Skylines, the podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman City site. It was presented and recorded by me, John Anidge, and produced by Nick Hilton. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on iTunes, Acast, or whatever other app you use to get your podcast. And while you're there, why not leave us a nice review to tell other people we're here? It really helps people discover the show, and I'm a megalomaniac, so the more people I can get listening to this, the better, really. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.